Hello, theater lovers. It's me, Bryn. Today, we are going to be going over the play Alternative Canon, a sacrilegious romp by Erin Proctor. She's an early career playwright, and I'm super excited to introduce her work to you guys. But first, our announcements. Speaking of Erin, she actually just started a playwriters group. A playwriters group. Great job, Bryn. A playwrights group for early career playwrights. I believe the working title is the Hot Sexy Playwrights Group for Early Career Playwrights. If you are interested in joining, there will be a link in her TikTok bio. Her TikTok handle is at Goody Proctor. So if you're interested in applying for that, I would head over there. There's some really fun and interesting audio things going on. Soundscape Theater, that I am often promoting, is having their first birthday. That's right, their first birthday. And their second annual Scarescapes. If any of you remember, last year I had a play in Scarescapes and it was super fun. So those will be coming out next month, which I know it's so weird, but October is only like 2 weeks away. I personally love fall, so I'm super excited for fall and for Scarescapes. So be sure to follow them on Instagram at Soundscape Theater so that you can be aware of when a new audio play drops. And it should be spooky, or at least have a spooky flair. I have been so busy at my new job, where I am a literacy teacher, which is super exciting and it's going to be super fun, but I have been training for about 8.5 hours a day and I'm exhausted. So those are the only two announcements y'all are going to get for this week. This episode, a little bit of a mess, but I hope y'all are in for the ride. Because it's still fun. It's a very fun mess. Hopefully things will get a little bit more back on track once I am in a more normal work schedule, which is, you know, not going to be 8.5 to 9 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's going to be a lot less than that. So once this horrible training is over, we'll be back to business as usual. So let's get into the dramaturgy for Alternative Canon, A Sacrilegious Romp by Erin Proctor. Erin Proctor, she, her, is a queer Jewish playwright, actor, dramaturg, and comedian from New York. She graduated this past May with a BFA in acting from the Hart School, a conservatory in association with the University of Hartford. Her play, Horny Bedroom Ghost, was selected as a semi-finalist for the Scranton Shakespeare Festival's Scranton Scratch Night this past summer. Here is a short summary of Alternative Canon from New Play Exchange. God has unveiled a brand new plan for humanity, and they've chosen a prophet. A newlywed teenager living in ancient Mesopotamia. Based incredibly loosely on the Old and New Testaments, as well as ancient Jewish apocalyptic scripture, this is the story of the matriarch, Sarah. Step aside, Abraham. It's a plan that's only 5,000 years in the making. All right, guys, just a quick trigger warning, not really for this section, but definitely for in the discussion section. And if you read this play, trigger warning for suicide, suicidal ideation, and sexual assault mentions, just so you know. This play is essentially a retelling of some very, very old Abrahamic mythology. So I'm going to do my best to break down the basics of the story of Sarah and Abraham, as well as some Jewish apocalyptic scripture or literature. So hold on to your hats. First, the story of Sarah and Abraham. According to the Encyclopedia Britannica, Sarah was promised by God to be the mother of nations. Sarah's doubt in God's message prompts her to give her maidservant Hagar to Abraham so that they might conceive a child through her. God repeats his promise to Sarah after this, which she greets with sarcastic laughter, which is apparently, well, not literally because of translation, but which is, it's written in Genesis. She does not take this well. She laughs in God's face. And then at 90 years old, yeah, you heard me, like 90 as in 90, God makes Sarah pregnant and she gives birth to Isaac. Insane. Why would you, I mean, being pregnant already sounds hard enough and then you got to put it on a 90-year-old woman. Like, what the hell are you thinking? Anyways, that's the skeleton of the story. And honestly, it's the only bit that you really need to know about to understand this play. That's really the only events that you need to know. But let's examine it just a little bit more because I think it might give us some unique insight. So in a lot of interpretations, Sarah represents like fear and doubt, and Abraham represents faith and hope. Sarah constantly doubts God's message to her that she will bear a son and be the whole mother of nations thing. I mean, I don't blame her, but yeah. So Sarah is often associated with fear and doubt. Abraham is the like protagonist of this story in the Bible, and it's him that's usually placed in the prophet's seat, hence giving him, you know, these representations of faith and hope because he's the guy. He's God's guy, you know? So obviously he would be the representation of the quote-unquote good traits. And also, apparently, and this is a little detail that isn't even mentioned in this play, but it blew my mind. So apparently Sarah gets jealous of Hagar later on when their sons, who are half-brothers, are playing together. And she finally just goes, Abraham, get her and her son out of here. I don't want them here anymore. And Abraham listens. Like, he just tells his baby mama and one of his sons to just GTFO. Like, just leave, bye, I don't care. Because God tells Abraham, well, you know, since Ishmael, your son with Hagar, is also your son, I'll make him, you know, a patriarch too. It won't be a big deal. So just, you know, let him go. It'll be fine. The Bible's weird. I have a lot of issues with that little bit of the story. It just seems a little nuts, but you know, let's not pit women against each other here, Bible. I mean, I'm asking too much of the Bible in that instance, I think, but you know. Basically, this play just takes the skeleton of this story that I went over at the beginning of this section, and it makes it into something that isn't patriarchal, but is instead matriarchal, which also fits in with a more Jewish look at the story as opposed to a more Christian look, since Judaism tends to have a more matriarchal view of things. For instance, if you are ethnically Jewish, that's quote-unquote passed down from your mother. Like, it's the matrilineal line that is followed in Judaism. So take that with a grain of salt because I'm not Jewish, but that's what all the research has said. Anyways, a lot of that stuff was rooted in my opinion of the Bible, so we're just gonna leave it there, and we're not gonna talk anymore about it. Let's move on to Jewish apocalyptic scripture, also known as Jewish apocalyptic literature. This body of work discusses, quote, the author's vision for the end times / end of an age, as revealed by an angel or other heavenly messenger. And that's according to scholar Michael Coogan, anyways. This genre spans over a large time period, from the Babylonian exile, which is described a little bit in the story of Sarah and Abraham, to the Middle Ages. These stories aimed to reconcile the suffering inherent in being a human person with God's message of love and righteousness. Also, this growing idea of the individual as a being separate from the collective is something that really prompted this, because as we all know, as time goes on and it's easier and easier to survive, like you have there's less risk inherent in your everyday life of being alive. Like, you don't have to run from tigers every day. you can have an identity as a individual separate from your collective community. All right. Anyways, these works aimed to show the continued righteousness of God despite worldwide suffering and the growth of individualism. And according to Wikipedia, apocalyptic prophets taught that the righteous person would not fail to attain through resurrection the recompense that was due in the messianic kingdom, or alternatively, in heaven itself. So basically, that is saying that a quote-unquote righteous person or a godly person, et cetera, would attain all of their rewards, you know, heaven and stuff. So you want to be a good individual, not just a good part of the community. Christianity later appropriated the hell out of Jewish apocalyptic scripture and made it the vehicle of its own ideas and purposes. Some examples of this are right in the Christian Bible, like the canon, quote unquote, Bible. The book of Revelation, for example, is literally apocalyptic scripture. That's exactly what it is. but some smaller examples are Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Jude 14 through 15. One could say that this led to the modern day fiction genres of post-apocalyptic or dystopian literature. Something we have in common with the people of the time in which apocalyptic literature was invented is a negative view of the present. I mean, currently as I'm recording this, it is the year 2021, and last year was, pretty much everyone can agree, was a very large garbage fire. So I think we can see the connection there. These authors saw what was happening around them in the present so negatively that the only thing that made sense was more negativity, i.e. like the end of times. So I could honestly write a multi-page paper on this after reading what feels like half of the Encyclopedia Britannica, but I won't do that. I do highly recommend doing your own research on this topic, though. It's fascinating, and it also sheds an interesting light on modern messianic or Abrahamic religions. I grew up Christian. I am no longer Christian, but growing up Christian and knowing a lot of this mythology very well, I mean, reading about this really interesting. Especially the connections that I began to make to modern day, like I said, modern day fiction genres of the post-apocalyptic and dystopian literatures. It's really interesting. Highly recommend. And with that, it's time for our reading portion. Today we have Lily Welsh back to read a monologue as Hagar. But first, a word from our sponsors. And now, Lily Welsh reading a monologue from Alternative Canon as Hagar.
Sarah has persuaded 300 Sumerians to journey with us to the land of Canaan. I don't know how she's done it. She had interrupted King Nimrod's court. Nimrod! I know it's a silly sounding name, but she had broken into his court and interrupted it. And she had inspired the audience, not the king, but the courtiers and servants and slaves and workers and mothers and fathers to strive for a piece of this promised land, a piece of a privilege that so many lack here, a piece of something worth striving for, to worship this mighty new God. Sarah is determined. And she is fierce, and she is powerful, and I stand right behind her. I don't know if I believe in her God, at least not in the way she does. She would die for her God. I just met this God about a month and a half ago. I need to know them a little better first. But I believe in Sarah. I don't remember life before Sarah. I don't remember love before Sarah. She is with child. She's getting a little chunky. She's glowing, actually. It's a boy. That's what Abraham says. That's what Abraham said an angel told him. I don't know what an angel is.
Thank you so much, Lily, for that stunning performance. If anyone would like to contact Lily with professional inquiries, her contact information can be found in the show notes of this episode. Hello. So, just a little interlude before we get into the interview. Something went wrong with my microphone during the interview with Erin. Erin sounds great, thank God. I, however, kind of sound like a robot. Now that's not a good... I sound like I'm speaking underwater. That is probably a better description. You can still understand me. The quality is just really poor. And I'm really sorry we didn't have time to re-record it because I just got a new job. And Erin is also a pretty busy lass. So unfortunately, there was no time to re-record the interview. Luckily, you can hear and understand Erin. So just wanted to put that disclaimer there. I am aware the audio is bad. Not sure if I need a new mic or what, but I still hope you guys enjoy it. Thanks, guys.
And now I'd like to welcome the playwright herself, Erin Proctor, to the podcast. I read her bio in the dramaturgy portion, so without further ado, here she is. Hi, Erin. It's so nice to see you.
Hi, it's nice to see you too.
Yeah, nice to meet you because I've only ever really talked to you on TikTok, weirdly enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, for those of you out there who don't know, I do have a TikTok, if you will. That's where I met Erin here, who also has a fantastic account that I'm sure we can plug at the end. Great theater community on there. I never thought about it until my brother is a... PR, he had like a PR minor or something in college, and he was like, if you want more listeners, you should get on TikTok. So
yeah. TikTok is a really big young, like early, like theater community of like, yeah
there are Broadway actors on there too,
so yeah, like literally everyone from like everywhere.
Yeah. So, yeah, if anyone wants, there's a whole dramaturgy side of TikTok that I highly recommend. Grace Walker has a TikTok she's acted on the podcast for in our 448 Psychosis episode, if y'all listen to that. So, basically, go check it out. oh, my goodness. And I actually heard about this play from a video that you did on your TikTok page, Erin. Did you know this?
What, 448?
No, not 448. Your play.
Oh, my play?
Your play. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Duh. No, because Erin made this video talking about this play, and I thought it sounded really funny. So we swapped new play exchanges. And yeah. I was like, this is great. I have to talk to Erin about this. Because as y'all know, I like to bring people from like all parts of the career as a playwright, you know, people who have been published, people who are just starting, people somewhere in the middle. And I thought Erin was a great emerging playwright to feature. Especially just because I am not Jewish, but one of my best friends is a Jewish convert and I grew up Catholic. So I was very familiar with the story of Sarai, Sarah, and Abraham. So reading this was it was a real relief in some way. those of you out there, if you have some religious trauma, this might actually be a good read for you. And what I liked a lot was you stayed true to the essential bits of the biblical story, but you put your own spin on the rest of it, and you told the essential parts with a certain amount of modern truth that really humanized every single character in the story. And I wanted to know how you approached the relationships between your characters, since these stories are so widely told, like everywhere.
I guess initially with the relationships, I'm trying to explain. So the first scene I wrote for the play is it's actually the second scene of the play. So that was the first scene I wrote. It was when I was in college. I used to work in the costume shop, and sometimes I'd dick around on my phone, and I'd write on my phone in my notes app when I was supposed to be working. And I just started writing that scene between Sarah, or she's Sarah earlier in the play, and Hagar. And it kind of spiraled into that, and I was like, do I want to incorporate God into this? And then I did, and I was like, okay, I want to do angels, and I want to make it gay, and I want to do this, and I want to do that. And I wanted to explore these biblical figures as human beings with, like, lots of flaws, because, mm-hmm. I mean, if you read the Bible, they're all pretty messed up people.
Yeah, the Bible is a pretty screwed up book, if you ask me.
Yeah, like, no one in the Bible is a good person except, like, maybe Jesus? I don't know.
Maybe, and you can even, there are those parts where he's a kid and he does some pretty shady stuff, so.
Yeah, so, like, no, but there's no perfect person in the Bible. Everyone fucks up.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to just explore that side of it, because I think it's really cool just humanizing these figures. And thinking about them as human beings.
Yeah, no, especially I love humanizing God, because something that I think is similar between a lot of Abrahamic religions is that God is this big, like, deity who can do no wrong and is, like, all loving, but also very, very scary and, like, I don't know. It's something that never sat quite right with me. But having God come in and just being like this non-binary person with, like, being like, sup, hey, yeah, I know it's screwed up. I don't care. And just kind of admitting that, being like, oh, no, I have this plan. Oh, it doesn't make sense to you. That's fine. I don't care. It's kind of like how, in my mind, how in mythology, in a lot of polytheistic religions, they're deities are very human. Like, they're very flawed and they make mistakes, and maybe that's why those religions lasted for a long time too. Who knows? Now I'm just going off on a tangent, but I really did like that about God and the angels as well too. How Metatron and Gabriel are just kind of chill.
Yeah.
Oh, I love their relationship. That we'll talk about later. But as individuals, they're just like, oh, yeah, no, we're angels. We're just doing the thing. God told us to do the thing. And we think it's dumb, actually. We think it's kind of dumb. But we're going to do it because, I don't know, they're God and we said it. So whatever. It was really great. Speaking of how the characters talk, I thought I'd ask you about the format of your dialogue, because it is formatted in a very specific way. It's almost like a poem, and the line breaks can serve multiple purposes. They can be pauses or moments where they stop and rephrase, or et cetera, et cetera. And I found that it made the dialogue have a very natural, but, like, pardon my musician, staccato rhythm. Was there a specific reason you wrote the dialogue that way, or, like, a specific way you approached the text?
When I write stuff, I like to write stuff how I hear people talk. So a lot of stuff is, like, based on how, like, people talk. Like, a lot of, like, Gabriel's lines is based on how, like, my friend Matt talks. I wrote that role for them to play, and they played it when we did a Zoom reading of it back in January. Great. We're still in the pandemic.
Yeah,
in the pandemic. So I wrote that role for them based on how their mannerisms and how they talk. So, and also I was very much inspired by, like, playwrights like Sarah Rule and Jeremy O'Harris and Sarah Kane, mm-hmm. and how they do their text. And so a lot of, like when I would, like, end a line and then go to the next line, it would be like, it would usually, represent a breath, mm-hmm. and a breath could mean, like, maybe it's a pause, maybe, like, they need to breathe, maybe, like,
yeah.
think, like, and it's only really a suggested breath, so, I mean, depending on the actor, they can do what they want with the text. I'm not a big stickler about that. Yeah. It's just how, when I wrote it, when I heard a breath, that's when I would go, okay, next line.
Cool. Yeah, I like that. It can be, I think that's very easy for an actor to interpret as someone who used to do that. it was something that I could see. I could see the rhythm of it, which I think makes it easier to read, and actually for cold readings too. I feel like a lot of these scenes would be great for cold readings because the rhythm's there. And I know some people can have trouble with that. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Sweet.
And I like to hear about the people that inspired you for text. I love Sarah Rule and Sarah Kane, especially. Why is everyone named Sarah?
You need to have if you're a playwright, I guess.
Yeah. Or like you say in your play, there are, God is like telling Sarah that all these people are going to be named after her. I'm like, yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, there are a lot of Sarahs, and I think it's kind of cool that some Sarahs inspired the dialogue when the main character is the Sarah.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Wow.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, and speaking on the woman side of things, I love that this play takes something very patriarchal and makes it more matriarchal, which, I mean, just as a woman is amazing, but also as a queer woman who grew up Catholic, there was a lot in this play that made me just go, yes. and at first was the relationship between Hagar and Sarah. And then, of course, the relationship between Gabriel and Metatron, which is so, I love how that whole arc goes. And then, of course, just having God be non-binary and everyone using they, them pronouns for them and no one questioning it ever. And the queering of like this mythology that I grew up with and that a lot of people grow up with makes it feel less like a like holier than thou parable and more like something that could actually have happened. So was the queerness something that you had in mind in the first draft? I mean, it seems like maybe because that first scene was between Sarah and Hagar, or like did the queerness come out more as you wrote
for the draft? The queerness was definitely one of the first things that there was, because everything I write it ends up being gay in some way.
Same, man.
Like it just does. Because when I write, I'm like, okay, what do I want to represent in my work? Like sometimes I write straight people. Like I write straight people sometimes, but most of the stuff, no, everything I've written has been pretty gay. So I'm like, okay, who would I want to explore? I love exploring things with the Bible. I've written a bunch of biblical stuff, some stuff on my NPX, some stuff I haven't posted anywhere. I think the Bible is such an incredible piece of literature, and I think there's so much, and I think about how in the past so much has been adapted from it, but we don't do that much anymore. And I feel like because a lot of people are scared of where they can go with that, because they're scared of who they might offend and stuff like that. Like even like a couple years ago, like in 2012, when The Testament of Mary was on Broadway, there was big protest for that. And that was in 2012.
Yeah.
And which is one of my favorite plays, by the way. I love that
play. That's really good. And I actually love that you end the play on Mary. It shows this cycle repeating.
Yeah, that's the one part of my play that's not very Jewy. That's where I'm a little bit of a bad Jew and I go into the Christian territory.
Oh, yeah. But it makes sense for the play for you to go there, because it closes and restarts this cycle of God using these mortal women without them consenting first, number one. And number two, without them even really being like super devout or anything. God just come down and be like, I like you.
Yeah, they're kind of just vibing, and then they're like, so
so hi, I'm here to ruin your life. I mean which I am a sucker for anything cyclical, but especially the Bible as literature, I think, is a very cyclical book. Throwing that in there, it all ties together very succinctly at the end. I think I got a little bit away from the topic of queerness, but yeah, no, it's, I mean, I Let me rephrase. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I really got into the play as soon as Sarah and Hagar were talking to each other, because it felt like a very honest relationship, especially after that first scene of Sarah's wedding night and how Abraham basically sexually assaults her. She doesn't want to be there. And it's horrible. And she doesn't have a good experience. And I think that's also something the Bible tends to leave out. Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that not all of these biblical women wanted to be where they were, where they ended up being in these stories. They were there because of a man. So you gave them back some agency immediately by having that relationship there, I think. At least that's how I viewed it.
Cool.
But on the topic of queerness, Metatron and Gabriel, I die. Because they're adorable, but also there's something really raw as Metatron kind of wrestles with this very human guilt about all of the quote-unquote cruelty that they've had to do for their entire angelic career, and how that affects their relationship and also doesn't. There are definitely parts in this play that are extremely funny, but there are parts that really aren't, that are more dramatic and more, like, raw is the best word that I can describe. And that was definitely one of my favorites. Was what inspired that?
I guess I really wanted to include other apocryphal literature other than, like, the New and Old Testaments. I've always been really into, like, non-canonical parts of Abrahamic faiths. I mean, some of them are canonical in, like, some places, like, in, like, the Ethiopian church, and, like, I think in some Ethiopian sects of Judaism, the Book of Enoch is canonical. But it was always just something that interested me because Enoch was a human man that became an angel, which wasn't a thing that really happened, except like him, and he was brought to heaven alive. That only happens with like a handful of people in the Bible. So I was like, and I was like, okay, the angels and God, they're like not human. They lack a lot of human like empathy. They're very apathetic. They're apathetic creatures. And I wanted to see, okay, what would it be like with like having like empathy and apathy just wrestling with each other? And that's where the idea for Metatron came from. And I, when doing research, I found out that a lot in some writings, the angel Metatron was who used to be Enoch.
Yeah, so I love that.
Where that came from. So a lot of it was just me nerding out with like biblical literature and reading that and cherry picking what I liked from it and putting my own spin on it.
I mean, hey, everyone else does it.
I mean, that's what everything is.
Yeah, exactly. And that is something as someone who loves the idea of reincarnation, this idea that in a way, in a weird roundabout way, Metatron is Enoch reincarnated, which is not something that was ever allowed, especially in Catholicism. Reincarnation was no. Despite the fact that I'm pretty sure directly in the Bible, it mentions John the Baptist being reincarnated, but you know, whatever.
What's the saying?
Whatever, like you're saying, cherry picking. So I really did like that. And I'm just going to go on a tangent. That honesty, I think I saw as well in Lot and the whole Lot and Lot's wife situation. Because I think in a lot of these biblical stories, we read them and we're like, ah, yes, why are you reacting like that? And not like, holy shit, what is happening? You know, they're just like, oh, okay, yeah, the biblical stuff, I guess this happens. Whereas when Lot's wife gets turned into a pillar of salt, which, by the way, I actually wrote down a quote from that part. I have to find it because it was like it tore me apart a little bit inside. Oh, where is it? Oh, yes. The fatal flaw of Lot's wife was that her heart was too full. Like, what? Like, the only, like, I, there's a whole theological conversation just in that quote that I could go on and on about. Like, the idea that is a full heart godly, quote unquote? Is a full heart righteous? Is empathy something that God values? At least in this play, I would argue maybe not, because God themselves doesn't really understand empathy because they are not human.
Right.
So that's a whole thing I could go on a tangent about. But really what broke me was the very real reaction that her husband has to literally seeing the love of his life, which is emphasized in earlier in the scene, the love of his life turned into a pillar of salt in beside him. And how he, trigger warning everyone, I already mentioned this in the beginning, but trigger warning, how he killed himself. Because like that, it's extremely tragic, but it is a very realistic reaction. And that's not something that the Bible, I think, allows, is these realistic reactions.
Yeah, because the Bible doesn't really give time for, it's just exposition and no characterization. They just tell you what happens. I mean, I think I'm actually a little nicer at a lot in mine than the Bible is, because doesn't like Lot's daughters have like sex with him or something?
Probably. I don't even want to think about that. But probably.
I think I'm a little nicer, but
yeah.
But like, because also what writing through this made me go through and actually read the Bible. And all of it is just like, and he did this and this and this and this, and then he was born, and then he did this and this and this. Like, there's no room for what happens in between that and how these people feel and like why these people make these choices. And like, all Lot's wife did to turn into a pillar of salt was disobey God. Like, why?
Yeah, and her disobeying God wasn't like she murdered somebody.
No, she just looked turned back. She just looked back. It's similar to the Orpheus and Eurydice myth.
Yeah, no, this idea of looking back, either metaphorically or physically, dooming somebody. Yeah, that's also a whole interesting conversation. but yeah, that, even though Lot and Lot's wife are that tiny, tiny little part, like right in the middle of the play, they really stuck with me. Because I think in a way it mirrored Metatron and Gabriel. In a weird way, for me at least. Wow, that got off on a tangent. Can you tell I have ADHD? I was speaking about humor earlier and how it contrasts with the dramatic content that we were just talking about. And the humor that you specifically use is this, I don't know how to describe it other than very blunt humor that is common like among Gen Z and millennials, kind of on the internet in memes and stuff, which you would think would seem out of place, but to me actually served to humanize the characters as well as modernize them. But what I really loved was the contrast between the blunt humor that could sometimes get a little dark and the, as we just discussed, absolutely heartbreaking events that happen in between. So did you intentionally approach the script with in your head, I'm going to balance this, I'm going to try and throw this in here in a specific way, or was it something that just happened or something you discovered in a later draft?
As I said before, the first scene I wrote was like the Sarah Hagar scene, like post wedding night, all that. When I started, the second scene I wrote is the second scene after that, the Breck with Nahor and all that. That was when I started to play with the dialogue a bit more with him, because I was like, okay, I want him to be a total himbo jock. So I was like, I want to make him talk like one. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna add more modern colloquials and more stuff like that. I was very much inspired by, have you ever seen the show Dickinson on Apple TV Plus? I highly recommend it. It's on Apple TV Plus. It is a period comedy about Emily Dickinson, and they speak in like modern colloquial language, like how Gen Z talks and stuff. And I was like, I really like it when in my notes, I say this is not a period piece because it's also not a period piece, but it kind of is. If that makes any sense? I don't know.
Yeah.
you, whatever you want it to mean. But I like it when stuff like that is, I don't know, modernized on a level where it's still like something like, okay, that is like really relatable. Like that you can just, I don't know, kind of see yourself in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's easier to empathize.
So far detached and removed using all this heightened text and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I mean, I love heightened text, don't get me wrong. But
it can be alienating, yeah.
Yeah.
And these stories already, I think, alienate a lot of people. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think modernizing the text also helps with that, too. Modernizing the language, for sure. But definitely on the balance of humor and drama, I mean, that's a hard thing to do. Did it take you a lot of drafts to do that? Or are you one of the lucky ones that this comes naturally
to? I would say a lot of it I also found through the doing. So, mm-hmm. I was very lucky to live. It was during the pandemic. I was in my senior year at acting school, and all of my friends are actors. So I got to have my friends read for me all the time. And when we were doing our reading, we would rehearse and I'd rewrite things and I would add things that they would say and they would ad lib. And I'd be like, okay, we're keeping that. And just, I'd be influenced by how they would interpret the text. So a lot of the stuff are based on how my friends talk,
mm-hmm.
which, yeah, I don't want to say I directly stole all of their speech patterns, but just a lot of just how we would just talk to each other, I would put how specific characters talk.
Yeah, and I guess that those naturalisms help with a balance, just because that's how a lot of us interact in real life. And lucky you, man, having a whole cast of actors to do that for you. All my friends are playwrights.
I missed it. Now I don't have that anymore because I graduated.
Oh, well, hey, listen, if I find any actors, I'll throw them at you if you do the same for me. But it can be really helpful in the writing process to have actors who are also willing to or okay with, like, occasionally ad-libbing something. So I know there are some actors who are like, I don't want to offend you. I don't want to, because some playwrights are very, like, I put that period there for a reason. And then there are some of us who are just like, I mean, I don't know. You think that's a question mark? Try it. I don't care. Let's see. And I think that can really help with pacing and all sorts of lovely things.
Mm-hmm.
And now we come to the dreaded question, the one all playwrights on my show hate, or love, depending. And it's, what do you want the audience to get out of this play after seeing it or reading it?
I guess what I want them to get out of it. Well, first of all, I want them to have a good time. Why did I write this play? I guess I want them to, I don't know, maybe feel like they want to do better even though the world seems hopeless, even though that everything seems predetermined.
Yeah. No, hey, like, that's a great message. That's great.
I mean, I feel like the whole theology, cosmology of the play is very nihilistic. But I I don't know. I want people to leave with a sense of hope.
There's nothing wrong with that. That's great.
I don't know if my play gives that. But
I think it does.
Okay.
I think it does. The cyclical nature of it can be viewed as nihilistic, but I also think the cyclical nature of things can be viewed as hopeful. But that's also me philosophizing and as a fellow playwright saying, and as someone who loves cyclical things. But I think that's a lovely message, and it may feel cringy when you say it or something. But that's very, very noble, for lack of a better word. And yeah. It's nice when those things come in a funny package. Because it's a funny play. It's a comedy.
Definitely a comedy.
With some dark, serious moments, but it's comedy. And I think ultimately comedy is there to do the things that you're saying. So, yeah, that's great. I support that. Oh my goodness. Well, thank you very much, Erin, for being here.
Thank you for answering.
Yeah, of course. No, I love making playwright friends. That's why this podcast exists, really. We all know it's selfish. But we all know why we're really here. So thank you so much. It was really cool to talk about this play with you. I really enjoyed it, and I bet our listeners learned some things, because I know I learned some things reading talking to you.
I go read it and then maybe want to produce it.
Yeah, no, if anyone out there is a producer, y'all know NPX. And
I can have an income or something.
Yeah, income's nice. So speaking of that, Erin, is there any socials you would like to plug, your website, anything like that?
You can follow me on Twitter at postproctorism. You can follow me on TikTok at goodyproc. You can follow me on Instagram as I gotta double check my Instagram name.
I always gotta do that too, don't worry.
It's Erin Proctor with 3 R's at the end. My website's erincproctor.com. If you want to go on there, nobody ever really uses my website. I have a website because when we had career prep class in my senior year, they were like, you have to make a website. So I have a website.
And then your new play exchange is just under Erin Proctor, right?
Yes. I think I'm the only Erin Proctor on there. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure you are. I'm pretty sure
Unless there's another one. If not, I might have to change my name.
Yeah. So if you have a new play exchange account, which I'm always telling you guys, it's literally $1 a month. It's really not affordable and worth it. Get one. Go read this play as well as all of the other ones that I've covered and mine. If you want to do that too, you could also read mine. Okay. Once again, thank you so much, Erin, for being here with us today, and thank you all of you out there for continuing to listen to this podcast. Like I said last time at our season 3 premiere, it has been a year since this podcast has started, and you guys are all mostly still here, which is awesome. So thank you. And y'all know the drill. If you want to suggest a guest or a play for me to cover, you can email me at theplaymatespodcast@gmail.com. Excuse me. You can also go to our website, playmatespodcast.weebly.com. And go up to our menu and you will find a little Google form that you can fill out, and that will let me know any guests or plays you want me to cover, who I should contact, if you know, etc., etc., all that fun stuff. And if you'd just like to say hello or see what the podcast or me is up to, you can follow us on Instagram at Playmates Podcast. I post pretty much every Thursday, Friday, Saturday kind of area. So you'll get all of the information you may want on the podcast and also on playwriting fun things over on that. All right. Well, I can't wait to see you all in the next episode, which, let me double check before I put my foot in my mouth, will be obviously a solo episode with me, because that's how we all go. And it will be in celebration of Halloween, it will be Scary Mary and The Nightmares 9 by Amy Escobar. That'll be a fun, spooky time. I love me some spooky. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Have a good rest of your week or month or whatever. Okay. Bye for now.